This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Jim White. How are you, Jim?
I'm good, thank you.
What is your role at Wiclardy Bay?
My title is Technical and Sustainable Development Director these days, but at the moment, I guess I'm looking after a wide range of activities across the business, from health and safety and engineering through to major projects, wine and grape supply, and then I do a lot of work with industry bodies as well.
You originally started out, well, you've been with Kate Mantel, who own Cloudy Bay.
Correct.
For a while, but you started out in Cloudy Bay as a viticulturalist.
Viticulturalist, yeah. That's why I studied viticulture in university and worked for 10 or 12 years in the Yarra Valley, prior to being offered the role at Kate Mantel. And so I headed over to Margaret River, 3.5 years, and then we got a phone call asking us to come over to Cloudy Bay in late 2010 and started here 15 years ago. Ran the vineyard department exclusively for 8 years and then took over the winery as well, overseeing both viticulture and winemaking for 5 years, and then sort of changed roles again just a couple of years ago.
Okay, so you're now part of their executive team at Cloudy Bay?
Yeah, very much so.
Okay, what we're going to do today is we're just going to have a chat about Cloudy Bay. Yep. It's been a while. The last person we had on our show was it Siobhan Harnett?
Siobhan Harnett, yeah, who was the viticulturist prior to my arrival.
That was probably, well, before 2010, so it's been a good 15 plus years since we've had someone from Cloudy Bay on the show. So what's happened in the last 15 years, mate?
Well, last year we celebrated our 40th anniversary, 40th vintage, which is a pretty big milestone, and not just a milestone, I guess, for Cloudy Bay, but a milestone for New Zealand wine more generally. You know, I guess it was those first vintages of Sauvignon in the mid-1980s that found their way out to the rest of the world and sort of piqued interest of the wine trade in what was happening here in New Zealand, the amazing Sauvignon Blanc wines that were coming from here. And I guess the industry around us has grown significantly and we've just chipped away playing in our sort of, you know, high quality premium end of the market. And now we sell our wines in something like 100 countries around the world and continue to grow year by year.
The old days, Cloudy Bay used to be very hard to get in the UK. You know, you almost had to be on allocation to get it. These days it's not so bad. Have you guys been ramping up volume or have you been...
Yeah, we've steadily grown. I mean, like the region, when they first made that first vintage in 1985, there was less than 500 hectares of vineyards here in Marlborough. And today we've got around 30,000 hectares of vineyards in Marlborough. So like Cloudy Bay, the industry has grown around us. We've chipped away growing slowly, maintaining our focus, particularly with Sauvignon Blanc in our sort of like the heartland of Sauvignon in the central part of the White Isle Valley, where we always made our Sauvignon Blanc from. And the region as a whole has grown up into all the plantable corners as wine companies have, you know, I guess meeting that insatiable demand for New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc across the globe.
Would you say Marlborough's planted out, or at least parts of it are planted out?
We're getting pretty close, yeah. Look, I think if you'd asked us 15 years ago, we would have said, oh, there's only 1,000 hectares or two to plant, and people have pushed into areas that would be otherwise seen as sort of marginal. And they still maybe are a little bit marginal, and fruit and wine quality is different and style is different to what we like to make at Cloudy Bay anyway. But yeah, I guess we're going to be reaching the upper limits because there really isn't any suitable land left.
We were over at Astrolabe tasting wines, just doing a bit of a tourism thing, Jay and I, last night, because we got in and there wasn't really anything open. So we thought, oh, just go and have a bit of a tasting at Astrolabe. And they've pushed right south down to Kaikoura now. Is that still part of Marlborough?
Well, they're in Kekeringa, which is sort of halfway to Kaikoura. And the GI itself is actually enormous and actually includes all the way past Kaikoura and over in the mountain range. And there's a Appalachian group here in Marlborough who are proposing to actually shrink that down and really get back to the core of what made Marlborough Marlborough. And it's the combination of rainfall, the maritime influence that is very strong here that really drives the climate and styles of wines. Those wines from Kekeringa are quite stylistically different from here in Marlborough, but they still have a very similar thread. What we don't as a region is to include areas that were almost included accidentally when they did the GI that really would make wines of quite a different style and quality than what we actually make in Marlborough.
Okay, let's go back to Cloudy Bay, because I'm going to cover Kikaranga. How many hectares does Cloudy Bay have now?
So we've got in total, we own 350 hectares of vineyards. We manage around another 150 hectares, and we've got about 100 hectares of growers as well. So all up about 700 hectares.
Oh, that's quite sizable, isn't it?
In Marlborough context, it's not huge, considering there are individual vineyards here are over 1,000 hectares. So, but yeah, we're a reasonable sized operation today.
And the wine range, you've got your Sauvignon Blanc, your classic Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc. You've got the oaky Sauvignon Blanc.
Tococo, yeah.
Tococo. How popular is Tococo?
It only accounts for about 2% of our Sauvignon production. I guess a wine that people always use as a benchmark for a Sauvignon that rivals the best of sort of white Bordeaux. It's certainly in hot demand. It's a wine that's on strict allocation throughout the globe. We just haven't got enough of it, so...
You could produce more of it if you want to.
We are trying to slowly. It's a slowly but surely. We've got to find the right quality vineyards. Winemaking-wise, it's quite particular in the fact that we've got to have a great collection of old oak. Most of it's fermented in old oak. Although it's using indigenous yeast and hand harvesting and the like, it's actually a particularly hard wine to actually make, irrespective of whether you're letting the process sort of go a little bit more naturally than we would do with a quite controlled winemaking style for our classic Sauvignon Blanc.
And then you've got your Pelorus, which is the sparkling wine.
Yep.
It's a traditional method.
Yes, it is.
One of the things I've been noticing coming around New Zealand is there isn't a lot of sparkling wines in New Zealand. People were having a crack at making carbonated Sauvignon Blanc for a while. Did you guys have a crack at that?
No, we wouldn't go anywhere near it. Yeah, we started making Pelorus back in 87, and I guess in 1990, Cloudy Bay was purchased by Veuve Clicquot, and so we've got a long sort of connection to Champagne as well. We've had a lot of sort of technical inputs from our colleagues in Champagne over many years. For us, you know, Pinot Noir and Chardonnay makes beautiful sparkling wines here in New Zealand. They are a little bit more fruit forward than wines that we see from Champagne and certainly from the UK. But for us, it's a really important part of our business. I think it's just a market size, and with a lot of sparkling wine being made around the world, the export potential is not as great as it has been for Sauvignon Blanc.
You say that, but one of the things we're seeing in the world at the moment, one of the big trends is a rise of sparkling wines. It's good that New Zealand's white dominated as opposed to red dominated, because obviously whites are more on trend than reds at the moment, and sparkling wines are even more on trend, and it seems that New Zealand's missing a trick with the sparkling wines.
I just think there's a fact, it's that local competition piece, and of all our wines has the highest level of technical acumen required for making it. You know, sparkling wine making processes, there's a lot of factors that come in through the process that help drive quality. And it may be as a case in New Zealand that there's not a lot of experience in sparkling winemaking as well. There's only a handful of, I guess, renowned sparkling producers. And so maybe that it, you know, is a bit of an issue of that sort of technical skill, as well as the very specialised equipment you need for disgorgement, tirage and the like.
Are you aware of anybody doing tank method sparkling wines?
There is one facility to do Charmat up in Hawke's Bay, I believe.
Okay.
But quite, again, relatively small volumes and mostly for the domestic market, I would assume.
Yeah, I'm exploring Albarino, and I tried a fairly decent peri-peri Albarino, sparkling Albarino.
Okay, yeah.
But I was just wondering whether that might have been a...
Could well have been Charmat, yeah.
It was from Hawke's Bay, so yeah. I have to check in that. You've got Chardonnay and Pinot Noir.
Yep.
The Chardonnay's, do you know what, I know I've had... Cloudy Bay Chardonnay. I just can't remember when and the name of it.
Yeah, no, well, it's Cloudy Bay Chardonnay. So we sort of have the sort of the classic range of Sauvignon, Chardonnay, and Pinot Noir. And they're the only three grape varieties we grow. Apart from, we've got 1 acre of Syrah that we inherited on a vineyard. But apart from that, no other varieties. In fact, we've been removing the likes of Pinot Gris, Riesling, Gewürztraminer over the last 15 years in my time here, realigning to what we do best. Our vision is to make less wines, but to make them better. So currently, we only make or sell 7 wines, 2 sparkling wines, a Brut and a Rosé, Sauvignon Blanc and Tococo, obviously both made with Sauvignon, a still Chardonnay, and then we have our Marlborough Pinot Noir, and then we have Tawahi, which is a Central Otago Pinot Noir as well. We've got some vineyards, small vineyard holding in Central.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw the vineyard holdings in Central. I was going to ask about that. That's a Pinot Noir.
Yes.
Which sub-region?
So it's in, I guess, the well, we now have two vineyards. Well, actually, we've got three. We most recently planted one, but we've got our Northburn site, which is on the eastern Lake Dunstan, so right on the lakefront.
Yeah, near Tarras or?
Further south than Tarras, closer towards Cromwell.
Okay.
And then we've got the Calvert Vineyard, which we lease, which is on Felton Road itself in Bannockburn.
Oh, yeah.
And we've most recently, just this year, planted a new vineyard across the lake up on the Sugarloaf Terrace, which is a elevated site at about 320 metres that's part of an old glacial outwash that we think has great potential for the future. And so we'll see that come to reality and as in the years ahead.
Where is, and I've heard of Sugarloaf. I'm from Otago.
Yeah, okay.
And I know the area reasonably
so
well.
So where the Northburn site is, which is on the eastern side, it's in between Bendigo and Cromwell, Northburn itself. And then literally if you look directly across the lake, there's a series of, you've got Lowburn and Lowburn Inlet, and then right up above that, above the lake, is the Sugarloaf Terrace.
That's not near Pisa?
It's again further south than Pisa. Pisa's further up the lake towards Wanaka.
Okay. So you're below Cromwell?
No, in between Pisa and Cromwell. That's on the western side of the lake, and then on the eastern side of the lake, our vineyard is in between Cromwell and Bendigo.
Okay, I'll have to look it up on a map and double check. How are you finding Central Otago? A lot of people make some lovely wines in Central, but it's not a particularly well-known region for making money.
No, it helps to have a lot of Sauvignon Blanc pay for our Central Otago project. It's viticulturally, it's very challenging down there. If it's not frosts at both ends of the growing season, it's wind at flowering. I guess the beauty of that quite high diurnal temperature range shift that we get during the growing season, amazing wines. The fruit is quite different in its sort of colour and tannin profile with regards to Pinot Noir than Marlborough. And we really like it because it provides a wine of, more architecture and more structure than we would naturally produce here in Marlborough.
Do you find the alcohols have always been quite high from Central Otago? Are you finding the alcohols are coming down? People often said, the alcohol come down over time. It's had a lot of time.
Yeah, there's a general trend in people picking a little bit earlier and looking for freshness in Central. And that idea of those big round fruit bombs of the late 90s and early mid 2000s, I think there's a conscious decision to harvest earlier. I think the concept of less is more is certainly at hand in Central Otago. And so we're seeing the wines looking a little bit lighter framed, a little bit more perfumed as, winemakers are maturing and understanding their sites better. And also that's typically the wines that the people making the wines love to drink.
What wine do you prefer? What's your favourite Cloudy Bay wine?
My own favourite is Sauvignon Blanc, actually. I fell in love with Sauvignon when I was I got to taste it at university and it was one of those sort of wine epiphany moments. And then I realised when they, it was blind tasting, they took the bag off the bottle and I recognised the label because it was the wine that I knew my mum loved and she drank it only on Christmas Day and on a birthday. And that sort of started my love affair with New Zealand Sauvignon. And then, I guess quite by chance, I ended up at Cloudy Bay many years later.
Was it Cloudy Bay?
Yeah, it was. It was the 1994 vintage of Cloudy Bay Sauvignon Blanc. And, the wines have this wonderful immediacy to them that you don't need to be a wine expert to understand Sauvignon because it gives you so much. And that even goes back to the vineyard. I remember first tasting as a young viticulturalist, tasting Sauvignon Blanc, and you really could get a sense of all those flavours, eating those grapes from the vine. And from that perspective, I just love a glass of Sauvignon Blanc. It can be that just classic aperitif, works super well with the fresh seafood we get around here. And it just is just delicious.
When I was in Hastings, we interviewed a guy called Mac from Advintage. He's a retailer up there. And we were asking him what do Kiwis drink? And he seemed to think Chardonnay was the wine. They don't really go for the savvy these days. Is that your experience?
The old anything but Chardonnay movement never, came but never really had an impact. I think New Zealanders, Kiwis drink a whole lot of wide mix of local wines. Yeah, I think it's still a very strong market for Sauvignon Blanc here.
I think his target audience in his wine business is slightly more high-end, and Sauvignon Blanc does come in at the sort of low to mid-price range.
Yeah, the bulk of New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc is very much in that, it's almost a fast-moving consumer goods in that sort of grocery channel. But you know, like ourselves and like other smaller producers in the region and across New Zealand, you know, we're stylistically trying to make wines that have much more levels of sophistication and elegance than, I guess, those cheap, incredibly high quality and very cheerful wines that the bulk of, you know, the New Zealand industry produces.
How do you build texture and layers within Sauvignon Blanc? I know about different picking times,
yep.
But what else is done?
Well, it goes back to sort of vineyard site and location. You know, we choose to grow our Sauvignon on the really sort of stony alluvial soils that have very little sort of available moisture here in Marlborough. So you've got naturally lower yields, and so you end up with this sort of fruit concentration. And I sometimes talk about Sauvignon being, you know, as a wine, it's quite transparent. You're really tasting, you know, the day of harvest, you're tasting that fruit profile. So ensuring you get open canopies, you know, not steering away from classic viticulture of things like shoot thinning and opening the canopies up. Managing yield is a particularly important thing for us. Then coming into the winery, Sauvignon winemaking is quite a precise process. And we have certain elements that we think are really important. Cold settling prior to fermentation. A lot of wineries here in New Zealand use a sort of quite rapid process to clear the juice with flotation. We think cold settling is really important. We still use a component of oak, it'd be those barriques or large wooden cubes for fermentation.
Even
for our standard Sauvignon, yeah, it typically runs somewhere between 2-4%, depending on the vintage. And with those parcels, you lose a bit of the overt fruitiness, but you gain sort of texture and weight. And that's something that we picked up, I guess, was one of our learnings traveling to Sancerre many years ago with my winemaking team is, you know, those wines are very much about texture and not about aromatics. And we've got truckloads of aromatics here. How do we build texture and interest in those wines? Obviously, picking at a suitable time. And we're really looking for, you know, that sort of citrus and stone fruit spectrum. A little touch of greens at one end of the spectrum, and we don't want sort of too much tropicals at the other.
So you're not going for the passion fruit?
Well, we get lots of passion fruit, but underlying that, passion fruit is an aromatic thiol. It's a transient aroma in wine. It doesn't really last for any more than 2 or 3 years. When those aromas disappear as the wine ages, we're looking for that core of sort of ripe lime, Meyer lemon, stone fruits, peaches, white nectarines, that sort of space. It needs to be the core, and again, that's site viticulture driven because there's no additives, there's no oak or anything you can add in the, you know, bringing other aromas or flavors in the winery. And then making sure the acidity is really quite high and fresh, but there's a roundness and a working for, I guess, we're a French owned company. We talk about gras, we talk about the wine having a bit of fatness and a bit of roundness as well, but with that mouth-watering acidity as well. And it's combining all those different elements together that I think makes a really beautiful Sauvignon Blanc, and that's what we aim to produce.
Just, you mentioned thiols and the passion fruit and not lasting too long. Is that the thing that causes Sauvignon Blanc to become that overblown sort of canned fruit type of canned peas, asparagus?
No, that's more the methoxypyrazine. So the ripening process of Sauvignon, it starts with a lot of those, you know, asparagus, tomato leaf sort of flavors, and that methoxypyrazines, which are obviously the characteristic that makes Cabernet Sauvignon and Cabernet Franc green.
Mm-hmm.
During early ripening, or if there's, you know, really high yields or certain sites, you tend to get a lot more of that methoxypyrazine being produced during the grape growing year, and then they degrade and disappear over time during the ripening phase. So if you pick your grapes early, you get lots of methoxypyrazine. If you harvest them later, as we do, we tend to lose all those methoxypyrazines, and you encourage the loss of methoxypyrazines through lower yields, having more open canopies, growing in sort of stonier, more free-draining soils versus other parts of Marlborough where, you know, the soils are very heavy. They're classically known for that grassy bell pepper, asparagus.
I was thinking that down Awatere.
Yeah, the Awatere Valley has that sort of nettles and tomato leaf character. The lower White Owl down by the coast here typically has more of those sort of bell pepper and asparagus, grassy Sauvignon aromas. And so there is quite a lot of sub-regional diversity here in Marlborough. And I guess for a lot of the big brands that people know that really are making a blend from all corners of the region, they tend to have the full spectrum of grassy through to, you know, lots of almost pineapple and some of those tropicals. We're looking for a much more narrow fruit profile, hence why we grow 95% of our fruit on those really free-draining soils, because we know that fruit character. It's our house style as much as anything.
Does that mean with the lack of methoxies in Cloudy Bay, you expect your wines to age better and not become overblown?
Absolutely, yeah. What happens is if you have a wine that has lots of those methoxypyrazines, but the wine also has lots of thiols, lots of passion fruit, boxwood. Sometimes people talk about cat's pee, that, you know, cat's pee on a gooseberry bush, the famous quote from Jancis. Once you lose those thiol characters, the passion fruit, the boxwood, what's left underneath is the core of the wine. If the wine is green and very herbaceous and has lots of methoxypyrazines, they're going to be there forever. If you don't have methoxypyrazines and you have this lovely ripe fruit, that's what's left once the thiols go. And so we see our Sauvignon, I think it ages magnificently. It's great to see Oz Clark just posted a bottle of him drinking a bottle of 2000 Claudie Bay Sauvignon Blanc just last week. The wine, those sort of citrus characters develop this much more sort of almost lemon curd. You get a toasty, honeyed note to the wines. They still retain beautiful acidity and that freshness doesn't disappear, but they get rounder and fuller in the mouth. And I always think about, you know, they follow maybe a similar trajectory as what Hunter Valley Semillon does, what old Chenin Blanc does. It gets rounder and sort of fatter, and that textural element becomes more sort of compelling, and they become beautiful old food wines.
Do you get tertiary aromas coming through?
You do. I guess the story of Cloudy Bay Sauvignon Blanc is the time under cork up until 2002, and then the time under screw cap, which is 2002 onwards. The 2002 onwards, the screw cap wines, we don't see tertiary aromas in those yet, and I think, you know, the beautiful thing about screw caps and Sauvignon is it keeps the wine so fresh and you don't get the impacts of oxidation because Sauvignon's very susceptible to oxygen. Prior to 2002, the wine's under cork. It's a game of roulette as to what you're going to get. Has the cork let too much oxygen in? That's generally the problem. And we see that both in the colour of the wines developing in bottle and just overt oxidation. And there's a reason that New Zealand shifted to screw caps, and it's because we're at the end of the earth growing the grape variety that probably has one of the highest susceptibilities to oxygen when it gets into bottle, and we were getting the most rubbish corks in the world at the same time. So that evolution for the industry to screw caps has, you know, meant that we've got an opportunity to examine our wines as, you know, 15, 20 year old wines and see those wines, you know, evolving in that sort of non-oxidative space that a screw cap provides.
So you prefer the wines in screw cap?
Definitely, yep. We've had, you know, suggestions that, oh, you know, if you're going to sell your wine in China, you need to put it under a cork. I mean, that's just a load of rubbish. We stick to our guns. We put them under screw cap because we trust every single bottle is going to be just like we expected it and we wanted it to be when the consumer gets it.
All right then, Jim, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.